Okay, good morning again. I think we've had enough time for everyone in the hallway to get in. If not, they will be coming in mid-session, which is fine. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my distinct honor to open the 115th Annual Conference of the American Society for Horticultural Science. It's truly a pleasure for me to welcome all of you to beautiful Washington, D.C. I used to live about 8 miles up from here, so I got down into the district fairly frequently. And I can tell you this is a beautiful city. And if you haven't been out and seen all the... Another thing is most everything is free. So you can go to all the wonderful museums and get this sense of American history. And I strongly encourage you to go out on one of the evening tours and look at the monuments and so forth at night. Because our nation's capital, if you can look at those monuments lit up in the light at night and not feel a sense of awe and feel the energy of American history, there's something wrong with you. So so I hope you will all go out and experience that. To get the meeting off to a great start, it is truly an honor to introduce this year's Tex Frazier lecturer. I've known Dr. Woodson for most of his career and my career, and I was used a few of my guilt points to get him to come at his extremely busy schedule as a chancellor of North Carolina State University, and from all the records of everybody I've ever heard, an extremely good speaker, so we're honored to have him here. The Tex Frazier Lecture Series was initiated to honor William Tex Frazier for his contributions to ASHS horticulture and horticulture, and to the integration of diverse disciplines within horticulture. Tex was a vegetable breeder whose last post was at Oregon State University. He was president of ASHS in 1969, and Tex died in 1995 at the age of 87, after a long and illustrious career and a wonderful, productive, and all people under the name, happy life. So, our speaker today is William Randolph Woodson. He was born in Arkadelphia, Arkansas, and grew up in the small town of Fordyce, is that right? Fordyce, Arkansas. The seeds of Randy's career in horticulture were planted at an early age in his life by his maternal grandmother, something we have in common, who was an avid gardener. He began his academic career at Louisiana State University in the Department of Horticulture in 1983. And moved to Purdue University in 1985. In 2010, Randy became the 14th Chancellor of North Carolina State University. Under his leadership, the university created and implemented the Pathway to the Future strategic plan that has elevated North Carolina State's recognition among the nation's top public research universities. Under his leadership, North Carolina State has become a preeminent research enterprise known for solving real-world challenges. Dr. Woodson's strategic vision has enabled the university to advance in areas of student success, innovative research, and collaborative partnerships. True to its land-grant heritage, North Carolina State creates economic, societal, and intellectual prosperity for the people of North Carolina and the country. With increasing momentum under Dr. Woodson's direction, Randy, these accomplishments were made with his leadership. Randy's also a past president of ASHS, and the title of Dr. Woodson's presentation is The Relevance of the Land-Grant University in Today's Economy, a subject that I think we're all very interested in. So I'll introduce Randy.
Thanks, Carl. Hello, everyone. You know, this is kind of like a Fellini movie. Everybody's the same, just older. So it's great to be back. Yeah, I recently went home to Fordyce for a funeral, and I go to my old home church, and, you know, everybody's walking by the front, and I'm thinking, wow, I've seen this act before. But it's great to be here at ASHS. I think the real reason that Carl invited me is because Michael said, you know, we got to get Randy to renew his membership. And so I did that yesterday. But I had to get it corrected because when I got the receipt from ASHS, it said William R. Woodson Woodson. So I got two names, and that's I didn't marry my sister, by the way, which in Fort Ice, Arkansas, is not unusual. Wow, did he say that? And he's still chancellor. So, you know, I'm going to do something a little different today. So when I'm, let me kind of lay out the strategy for the talk and what I hope to accomplish. And when I do that, you may want to leave because you've already heard the talk. But I'm going to talk a little bit about the political landscape and the challenges that we face in public higher education. And it's different in different states, but there's a lot of similarity. I'm going to talk a little bit about the historical context of the Land Grant Act. And I'm going to use a lot of references to the university that I have the privilege of leading. And I'm doing that not because bragging or anything other than it's what I know. And I think actually it reflects a lot of the work that all of us are doing across the country in different contexts, depending on the environment you're in and the political pressure you're under, the agriculture you serve, the industries you serve, et cetera. So you'll get a little bit of history. You'll get a little bit of what I think is the need for the land-grant universities in particular to reimagine themselves. Actually, I've just finished reviewing a manuscript by Gordon Gee, the roving president, who's the president of West Virginia University for a second time after being president of Ohio State twice, and Brown and Vanderbilt in between. Interesting dude. But he's written a book on reimagining the land grant system. And it's forthcoming, but I was asked to review the manuscript for a little blurb on the jacket cover. So I don't think I'll steal a lot from Gordon, but you know, sometimes we do. In having just read something. So that's what my intent today is. Let me start off by, I know a lot of you don't wake up every morning and read the Chronicle of Higher Education. That's a good thing, by the way. But some of us do. And a few months ago, there was a report from the Pew Charitable Trust that did a survey of Americans. And it was a political survey in that it divided Americans by party, Republicans and Democrats. Those are our two parties right now. And they asked them about 10 institutions in America, things like Congress, the church, higher education. And they asked, are these organizations, a simple question, are these organizations moving the country forward or backwards? 80% of the Republicans said higher education was moving the country backwards. 80% of the Democrats said higher education is moving the country forward. Now, I experienced this on a personal level because we have a very conservative General Assembly, and I'm interacting with them always, you know, trying to get money. And, you know, and many of you have been in this theater where a dude comes up to you and puts his arm around you and says, you guys are coddling those young people and just turning them into liberals, and I just don't like higher education. And it pretty much sounds like that from the mountains of North Carolina. And then he squeezes you real tight and says, by the way, I hope my daughter gets into NC State. It's like, dude, you just trashed us. I mean, you just said we're not worth the powder it'd take to blow you to hell, but you want your daughter to come. So that's the challenge we face now. We're viewed as organizations that aren't always relevant to the needs of the community and society. And, you know, I'm sorry, I'm going to go on a little too long, aren't I? But also, recently I got the joy of presenting to our governing board on why we invest in diversity on our campuses. And it's kind of intuitively obvious, you know, companies are looking to diversify, our population is rapidly becoming a majority minority, on and on and on. And after I give all this eloquent description a dude in the back, a member of the board, said, well, you're just trying to create a bunch of liberals. And I said, well, I don't wake up every morning trying to educate 35,000 students to be liberals. But what I do is wake up every morning trying to think about the skills they need to be successful in a global marketplace. So we got some real challenges here in higher education. I hope to address some of them today. That's a long introduction. All right, so let's go back to the Morrill Act. And to remind you all, at this time in our country in 1862, we were probably as politically divided as we are today. And we were in the middle of the Civil War. And I'll remind many of you that the Morrill Act had been passed by Congress in 1857, but vetoed by Buchanan, a fine leader for this country. And the Southerners prevented that veto from being overridden. And in fact, it wasn't until the Southerners were gone, and I'm one, God-fearing, it wasn't until the Southerners were gone that Abraham Lincoln took advantage of that fact to pass a renewed Morrill Act, in this case, adding military science to agriculture and mechanical arts. So it was really designed to meet the needs of society at a time, as Justin Morrill said, that not merely those folks that are going to universities for sedentary professions. You know, preaching was a big one, and medical doctors and lawyers. And, you know, the Southerners really wanted higher education to remain for the elite. So it was founded on a principle of education that's relevant to the needs of the state where it was located and relevant to the needs of the country. I'll remind you what the country looked like in the 1860s. This is the population density in these great United States of America. And you see there's not a whole lot of folks where I live now or south of where I live now, but a lot in the Northeast. A lot of that had to do with the lack of air conditioning, but it also had to do with the industrial strength of the country was in the Northeast. And the South was where the goods were produced, sent to the Northeast for manufacturing, and then the Southerners bought it back. Now, I'll remind you what we look like now. We're much more blue across the country, and if you look at shifts in the census, I can assure you that in 2020, you'll see continued growth in the southeast part of the country. North Carolina, for example, Raleigh, my county, Wake County, is growing at about 160 people a day. So there's a lot of migration to our part of the country. So, and if you think about it in the context of the population and the share of population, the urban share was very small when the Land Grant Act was passed. But there was a real need for an industrial revolution. But the agriculture workforce was quite strong and a large portion of the mass. In fact, if you look at the exports of our country in 1860, agriculture was almost 90% of the exports for America. And if our government doesn't screw up, I'm sorry to be so bold, but screw up trade, agriculture is still one of the exports from our country that brings a trade balance back to the United States. And a lot of our colleagues that we support every day in agriculture are real worried about the trade war that it seems to be underway. This is North Carolina in 1860, a very rural state, very agrarian state, and a real challenge. Now, when you think about our university, and you compare that to the modern economy that we're all trying to support today. I always pick out somebody in a clean suit, you know, attaching stainless steel tubes, and that looks sophisticated. This is the birth of our university. Now, many of you are from states that have two flagship universities. You know, you have the Land Grant University, and you have that other one. And in North Carolina, in 1862, the southern states were kind of busy. And so there aren't a lot of southern land-grant universities that were founded until well during Reconstruction. And that was true in North Carolina. But we had, and with all deference to the University of Georgia, and Georgia and North Carolina, University of North Carolina fight every year about who's the oldest. So I'm not going to make a statement there, but let's just say the University of North Carolina existed in the late 1700s and was there when the Land Grant Act passed. And so the land grant, North Carolina got, like every other state, 30,000 acres of federal land to sell. And there was no federal land in mostly in the east, so thank you, Nebraska, because Nebraska and other western territories contributed most of the land that was sold in the eastern part of the country for the creation of land-grant universities, and ours came from Nebraska. So it was sold. The endowment was created at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, but the faculty refused to teach engineering and agriculture. It was beneath them. It wasn't dignified. And so as a result, for 10 years, we had a land-grant university that would not be a land-grant university. So a couple of guys went to the legislature and fought to create a new land-grant university. That's North Carolina State. And so we were created, but I'll tell you the truth, I believe that endowment is still at UNC Chapel Hill. And I've sent the chancellor an invoice, because I've added it up over the years, and that would amount to about $180 million now, or maybe even more. And so I was conservative in my calculations and sent a $180 million bill to the chancellor, but I've not heard back. But this is what started our great university. You all have stories like this. Everything was in that one building when we launched, everything, including the gymnasium, the infirmary, the dorms up on the third floor. It was all there. So from that humble beginning, like all of your others, we've created a university that has 35,000 students and a lot of disciplines. And I think Justin Moore would be pleased. If you go back in time, you know, we also used youth education throughout our history as land-grant universities, not to educate the youth as much as to indoctrinate their parents. So the whole goal of the progenitors of 4-H was to get parents to use new technology, and they were resistant to that. It started as corn clubs in North Carolina before 4-H, and it started as tomato clubs for canning clubs for the women in society. But, you know, today in our state, 4-H serves over 200,000 students. Young people that in all sorts of disciplines, agriculture, STEM, science and technology, engineering, mathematics, and all sorts of things that gets them ready for college. This is a tremendous asset for us, and we need to use it wisely because it brings a lot of credibility to our universities. So land-grant universities have the unique, in my view, opportunity to inspire and to educate and prepare students. All universities are supposed to do that. We do it in the context of groundbreaking research, but we also have the secret sauce of being well connected with our communities. And the one theme that I want you to go away from this understanding about the need to reinvent this system is the need for us to be more connected to our communities. And I mean this. I mean, in a very tangible way, where you're not just serving them, but you're getting information back from our constituents. And the universities that do this well have the most political support, get the accolade, and it's in economic development, it's in all sorts of areas. So in our case, and again, I'm doing this because I know it, you know, we have, like many of other states represented here, we have research centers all across the state. Our state, very diverse agriculturally, 90 commodity groups. We always fight trying to say who is the most diverse agricultural state in the nation. And, you know, there are others equally diverse, but we're very diverse. And we run from the mountains of the west to the coastal plains and everything in between. And so we have research stations that address all of these needs. Also, we're the largest landholder in the state of North Carolina. And I bet you that's true of a lot of the land-grant universities that are here today. One example is we own an 80,000-acre forest near the coast of North Carolina. And I learned how critical that forest was when I tried to sell it. That's another story, but we still own the forest, but we got $80 million from a contractor to do a long-term timber lease on it and manage it sustainably. So we got upfront money, put that in the endowment, let somebody else manage it for in a sustainable way, and 50 years from now we'll get it back and we can do it again. But in any event, we own a lot of land. We also are committed to extension by having offices in all 100 counties, plus the Cherokee Nation. And that's important. And a lot of places have struggled with this financially. But it brings a lot. It's a front door to the university in many rural communities. I don't know about your state, but the urban-rural divide is real in North Carolina. Almost all of the growth is in Raleigh, Charlotte, Asheville, and Greensboro. But the politics are local. I don't know if it's gerrymandering. I'm not going to go there. Wouldn't go there. But the reality is, when you look at the General Assembly, it's a very rural General Assembly. And they're elected in rural districts. And our extension offices and our research farms and our engagement across the state pays dividends. And it's important for the state. I'll tell you the other challenge that land-grant universities have lost sight of. You know, a number of us all want to be those elite public universities. And the reality is many of us, and it's certainly true for North Carolina State, have more applicants than we could ever come close to educating. For example, for us, we had 30,000 applicants for 4,500 freshman spots. So it's very competitive. And a lot of people believe the land-grant mission was to educate the masses. Now, it's never been everybody gets in. But that's the perception people have. I'll give you, when I got to NC State, that my board said, here's our mantra, easy to get into, hard to get out of. Carolina, hard to get into, very easy to get out of. You know, look to your left, look to your right, only one of you is going to be here at the end of the semester. Well, that works real well when students aren't taking out debt to go to college, when we're not being judged by our boards and by the federal government on graduation rates and all the other things that are affecting us. So how do we maintain our strength and our open access in an environment where, I mean, I think this year our average SAT was close to 1,400. So, I mean, how do you deal with this? Well, I'll give, John Dole is in the back, your chair of your board, is that right? John is the Associate Dean for Agriculture for Academic Programs in the College of Ag and Life Sciences, and they've worked very hard, and there's some acronyms here, like the STEAM program. The STEAM program is an attempt to take young people in rural counties in North Carolina, give them help and assistance, give them a pathway to get to NC State, and you're all doing this. More work with community colleges, everything that we can do to make sure that the parents of children all across the states that we represent have access to our universities. And then provide support for them when they're there. Because it's not the same as it used to be. It's not let them all in and flunk them out. Now, the faculty aren't going to make it easier, right? So we have, and we're getting a lot of students now that frankly wouldn't have come to the university before because they've been well supported throughout their academic journey. So there's a lot of work here that I think for land-grant universities to remain relevant, we've got to address, particularly universities like ours in growing states with growing applicant pools and a very restricted admissions process. The other thing that I think we can do a better job in the future, you know, somebody once told me, and Hazel, she's somewhere here, and I both shared a pass or a current for Hazel and a pass for me of chairing the Horticulture and Landscape Architecture Department at Purdue. And, you know, the thing that I came to appreciate when I was a department chair is universities have departments, but the world has problems. And when the world is looking for solutions to their problems, they don't need to knock on 65 departments' doors to try to figure out how to get faculty to work together to solve some crisis. So increasingly, we're looking for our faculty to be interdisciplinary. And none of us have quite figured this out. You know, because you can't blow up departments. You got to have some structure for people to find a home. One of the things that we've done reasonably successfully is we've had a number of cluster hiring projects. And the difference of our success here and some others that have tried this is we put structure around this. We put tenure processes around it. We put administrative support around it. And so we're hiring faculty from different departments in things like emerging plant diseases and global food security. And they're all over. We have a cluster that's probably one of our most successful in genetic engineering and society, which is the philosophy department, entomology, crop sciences, et cetera. And it's led by a preeminent entomologist, Fred Gould, a member of the National Academy that has studied the emergence of resistance in genetically engineered crops. And so it's been a great platform for us. So that's one thing that I think we're going to have to figure out as land-grant universities. How do we structure faculty to get them and encourage them to work together? Another thing that I think we can do a better job of is community engagement. I'll use one example for us. So in North Carolina, we have these things called hurricanes. And they're a little different than tornadoes, which I experienced in Indiana, because in Indiana, you're not sure where they're going to hit. But hurricanes, you see it coming for a few days. And then it comes, and wow, is there a lot of water. And so we have a community in North Carolina. It's the first community in our state developed by freed African-American slaves. And it's Princeville, North Carolina. And as you would imagine, the communities didn't give the newly freed slaves the best land in our state. So this community, which is a tight-knit community, is in a prominent floodplain in the state and recurring flood problems. And Hurricane Matthew came through a couple of years ago, inundated this city, destroyed the homes of 80% of the population, all of the industry there. And this is an opportunity for a university like ours to send urban planners, landscape designers, political science students, and people into the community to help them reimagine their future. And these are things that we all do. But every one of these projects adds relevance to us as land-grant universities, and it goes well beyond agriculture. Now, one of the success stories in North Carolina is Research Triangle Park. And I have a hard time imagining what Luther Hodges, the visionary of this 50 years ago, had in mind when he stood in the middle of a pine forest and said this would be a great research park if we could get Duke, NC State, and UNC Chapel Hill to collaborate. And it's been a huge success for North Carolina. To be honest with you, they're struggling now. And they're struggling because new emerging technology companies don't want to be in the woods. So if you've been to Research Triangle Park, if you've visited Bayer or Syngenta or BASF, you know that there's these isolated alcoves of technology with a bunch of forest around them. And most of the growth companies today want to be in urban environments. They want their employees to be able to walk to work. They want to be in a dynamic region that has music, food, on and on and on. And so Research Triangle Park is struggling a bit, but it's been a boon to Centennial Campus, which I'll talk about in just a minute. But the point is that it was envisioned years ago that our universities added value and could be the centerpiece for recruiting industry to our state. And that continues to be the case for industry, their view of us, but I'm not sure it's universally viewed that way by the politicians. The other thing we can do a better job, in our case, you know, somebody asked me one year after I was chancellor, what was the biggest surprise? And I said, every morning I have to wake up and read the statewide newspaper, and two universities that are in the same athletic conference are 15 miles apart. And, you know, at Purdue, I didn't have to worry a lot about IU because they had their own media coverage and we had our own newspaper and we didn't, but you know, wow, you're in a market where every night on the television, and it's all about athletics, by the way, but it is quite interesting to be in an environment. I think there are very few places like this. I mean, certainly the area around Stanford is this way and the area around Boston, but to have, you know, three universities with $2 billion in federal funding within 15 miles is pretty unusual. But we don't, our faculty collaborate, but we don't do a lot academically together. And so we formed a true joint academic department with Carolina. And God, was this hard. I'm serious. I mean, this is painful. But, you know, a lot of biomedical engineering departments have joint programs at the graduate level, but not a joint undergraduate degree. And we've done this, and it's working, but it does bring challenge. And, for example, you've got to go all the way to Washington, D.C., and sit down with the folks in the U.S. News and World Report office and convince them to jointly rank you because they just don't know how to do that. And so we were getting penalized in our rankings for biomedical engineering because they would take the UNC faculty, the NC State faculty, and divide everything instead of looking at, they're all jointly hired, they're jointly tenured. It took us 2 years to convince them it really is a joint department, and you got to give us the same ranking, as each university. Another example for us, textiles. You know, so North Carolina was a huge textile state, and that was, textiles and furniture was our manufacturing. It's gone. But by the way, textiles isn't gone. It's different now. It's not socks and underwear. Although everybody here wears socks except Kurt Rome. You were waiting on that. I think he's got some little ones on, but that's a different. So what North Carolina's industry has emerged as is a real technology industry in things like filtration, medical devices, textiles that are used for other things other than woven material. And so we have, I think, one of the only remaining college of textiles in the country. So we're number one. I tell that to the dean all the time. He doesn't think it's funny. But we've got the only college of textiles, so we're the number one college of textiles. But we partner across the state, just the way we do in agriculture, to bring relevance to this industry. Now, our big play is about 25 years old. And it's this, I'm pointing to my screen. That's a little ridiculous, isn't it, Mike? So Centennial Campus is the campus in the foreground of downtown Raleigh. So we had a visionary governor. There are still a few of those in America. And this visionary governor was closing down a state mental institution, which all of us had. And in the old days, prisons and state mental institutions had farms. Any state organization always had a farm associated with it to feed, the patients, et cetera. And this farm was about 1,400 acres. And the governor said, I've got a lot of pressure to develop this for the private sector. How am I doing? And they want it back on the tax dole. He said, but I'll give it to you if you commit to developing it through public-private partnerships. If you commit to developing it not just as an academic campus, but as a commercial active enterprise. And it's called Centennial Campus because it was given to us on our centennial. And this is an example of some of the things I think we all need to be thinking about for relevance. So this campus has about 76, at last count, partnerships. The way I like to describe it is there are 6,000 people that come to work at my university every day on this campus, and I don't have to pay them. So there, LexisNexis, it's an Elsevier company that does, it's the Google of the legal profession. and all of their software designers for the search engines for case study and law are on NC State Centennial Campus. ABB, a power electronics company from Switzerland. They have, so LexisNexis, 700 employees. ABB, 800 employees. Eastman opened an innovation center. The one up in the top in the center, we have a National Security Agency lab on our campus. 100 analysts, they're kind of behind a curtain. But, you know, so we have government partners. APHIS is on our campus. USDA ARS has scientists there. But the point is, it's created a real, it's a real benefit to us because, number one, we don't have to pay to build the infrastructure. The way it works is they build the buildings, they pay us ground lease on the ground that we own, and that ground lease, it goes back into providing the infrastructure for the campus. So we don't make money off of this. We benefit from their presence. They hire our students. I jokingly tell alumni it's the only place where a student can go to school in the morning, an internship in the afternoon, and get a job after graduation and never leave the building. Now, it's not quite true because they got to sleep somewhere else and eat somewhere else, but it's a great benefit to us. And because it's an urban core, we're seeing a lot more interest in companies joining us on this campus. The other thing I think we can do, and this is a plea to faculty, is I think we can do a better job as land grants of reimagining our curriculum. And, you know, developing new curriculum is really a painful process on a college campus. But let me give you one example of being nimble. So there's this company that spun out of NC State in 1979 called SAS. It's a data analytics company. It was founded by a faculty member at NC State, Jim Goodnight, and his PhD student, John Saul. And it's still privately held. They're the 29th and 41st wealthiest people in America, because they own the entire company. So Jim Goodnight, the first year I was in NC State, called me and he said, "Your graduates suck." Well, I mean, that'll get your attention. And he said, "No, let me explain. You produce great applied mathematicians, great statisticians, and good business leaders, but none of them understand data and how to use it. And we need a new degree program in data sciences." This was before everybody started launching data sciences degrees. So 10 years ago, we created a master's degree in advanced analytics, and we did it the non-traditional way. The students go to class 40 hours a week in a building where they're all working together. So they're not moving between classes, and they're working with the same group of faculty, and they're working on real-world data. And we've been producing about 120 graduates from this degree program every year for the last 8 years, and their average starting salary is about $126,000, and they average 8 job offers per graduate, and it only takes them a year to get the degree because they're doing it night and day. Okay? So my point here is that I think we have a real opportunity to lead the way among public higher education of being responsive to the needs of industry. And you see a lot of demand for credentialing now, where industry doesn't, they've got a employee that's got a bachelor's degree, and they don't want them to take the time for a master's degree, but they need to develop a skill. And universities have an opportunity to create educational programs that are built around 2-3 courses and give a certificate that gives them the merit badge that all good boy and Girl Scouts want and gives them value back to their employers. And we're doing that actually directly with certain employers. We benefit from being in a region where there's a lot of, you know, technology companies, but we have educational programs for Cisco, for example, where all of their employees come and get certification in this case in blockchain technology. So there are opportunities there, and I think if we're going to remain relevant, we're going to have to listen to to the way the private sector, including our leaders in agriculture, are looking for education to be delivered. We've done this for a long time. I mean, back at Purdue, years ago, we launched a summer program, summer short course. And we brought farmers in every summer and gave them advanced skills in a variety of areas. And those are more loyal alums to that College of Agriculture and Life Agriculture than almost any other alum. So we've been doing this for a while, but we need to brag about it. I've already talked about these guys. The other thing, the benefit of getting these people on your campus, is they give you things eventually. Now, you make them mad if you ask for things too early. What I mean is things like endowed professorships. You know, so you got to develop the relationship. They've got to understand the mutual benefit. And eventually, you start to get, you know, we have, going back, we have two endowed chairs from ABB. We have a new endowed chair from Eastman. So it comes with time, but it can't be the first thing you ask for. Also, having this campus and campuses like it around the country allows you to expand when you get big research projects. And so we have a couple of big engineering research centers, and having Centennial Campus as a way to launch those was very helpful. The other thing we can all do a better job on is the entrepreneurship side of what our students are looking for, launching companies and growing the economy. I'm going to speed up, Mike. You're looking at me. So this is the proud brag moment, and I'm going to give a shout-out to Rich Linton, the Dean of Agriculture. We're in a great spot in North Carolina in having, you know, some of the major ag biotech companies within down the street from NC State, Syngenta, BASF, and Bayer. And we also have diverse agriculture. And Dean Linton and his colleagues did a great job of getting all of agriculture in the state of North Carolina, including our big animal agriculture group, to support we're calling a plant sciences initiative, but the centerpiece of it is a $160 million new plant science research complex. It's under construction, or design and construction as we speak. And so this is an example of where relevance to your community can pay off in the long run. In this case, the legislature did a bond package for building buildings on campuses. We were the only university that got two buildings. And the main reason was, as we said, if you give us the money for two buildings, if you just give us half of the money, we'll raise the rest privately. And we've done that. And as a result, now we have both a brand new engineering complex and a plant sciences building under construction. But the other unique thing about this building is the north wing of this, the one that juts out from the fume hoods, is potential commercial space that can be leased to startup companies or leased to big corporate partners for private proprietary research. And we were able to get some rules changed in the state that allowed us to do that, to build a state building that houses private enterprise. So land grants' continuing relevancy is really, in my view, through engagement, through the relevance to your communities. All of us have different economies that we're trying to support, and it's deeply entrenched in agriculture, but it's well beyond that across all of the industries that we support. And you've got to align the university with the economic reality of your region, and you've got to be seen as an engaged partner. And we've got to constantly communicate the value, which I don't think historically we've done a very good job of. What a lot of our legislators see is universities that have faculty that are writing letters to the editor every day complaining about the conservative legislature. At the end of the day, that doesn't really help you. Now, that's not NC State. But it's true across all of our country now. The political divide is real, and it's having an impact on the way higher education is perceived. So at NC State, we've adopted a very land-grant ISC motto, which is think and do. Think and do the extraordinaries, because our campaign, we're raising money. But think and do hangs all over on our campus, and it reflects what land-grant universities have always done. The best scholars, the best scientists, but also a commitment to getting it done, whether it's plant breeding and getting a variety into the field or an engineer that gets a product into commercialization. So that's my story, and I think I'm done. Thank you. 45 minutes.
On behalf of all the ASHS memberships, I would like to sincerely thank you for a very enlightening and thought-provoking presentation. And I would also like to thank you for renewing your membership, because I told Tracy I would get you to. but the reality is, we always consider you a member whether you paid or not. We're just happy you're paying, though.
Yes. So.
All right.
Do I go down?
You're welcome to sit or
whatever you're comfortable with.
Okay. All right. At this time, I'd like to continue with the next phase of the program today, and that is the presentation of the 2018 class of ASHS fellows. In our society, there are members in the society who have made such outstanding contributions.
Microphone.
Oh, sorry, I'm too far away from the microphone. In our society, there are members who have made such outstanding contributions to horticulture research, teaching, extension, and administration on the national and international level that their dedication and service to our society warrant special recognition. It's my privilege today to formally recognize some of those members in the audience today. I'd like to now announce to you the 54th class of Fellows of the American Society for Horticultural Science. Our first, if you would, when your name is called, start working your way up and come up this side of the podium, and we will present you a plaque and exit the other side. Our first fellow is David R. Brilla. David here? Okay. David Brilla has devoted 30 years to horticulture, to the horticulture industry. He is recognized internationally for his expertise on mycorrhizal associations, root physiology, and water and nutrient management of tree fruit, vegetable, and especially small fruit crops. His findings have been adapted by the industry and are helping growers to reduce losses and improve productivity by millions of dollars each year. His contributions to ASHS include many outstanding publications, years of dedicated service as an associate consulting and consulting editor and a member of the editorial board of Hort Science, chairing sessions at the conference, and organizing and participating in numerous workshops and colloquia. If the awardees for the fellows and the other awards this morning will stay after the presentation over here, we'd like to get photographs. So, our next fellow is Michael J. Havey. You here? Dr. Havey has directed the USDA onion breeding and genetics program for 30 years and is the largest of the public sector onion breeding programs in the U.S. He has served as project leader of major USDA-funded competitive grants from the Specialty Crops Research Initiative to develop translational genomics for onion and select and release germplasm resistant to Irish yellow spot virus and thrips, the most serious pest of the onions in the U.S. In more basic research, in his USDA position, he has taught at least one half of graduate level classes in 1990 at the University of Wisconsin. He served as chair of the graduate program in plant breeding and genetics for more than 15 years and has been actively involved with training of the next generation of horticultural scientists. Our next fellow is Dean Adam Kopsel with the University of Tennessee. I'm still trying to claim him. With the University of Florida. We're not giving up claim, Dean. Sorry. Dean Kopsel is a professor and chair of the Environmental and Horticultural Department at the University of Florida. He has held faculty positions at the University of Tennessee and the University of New Hampshire. Dean has been a member of ASHS since 1995. Dean has also served as Research Division Vice President and as member of the ASHS Board of Directors. He served ASHS through membership on nominations, elections committee, and the annual Conference Technical Program Committee and the National Issues Committee. Dr. Coxall has been active in many ASHS professional interest groups. Got it right this time, Mike. Not working groups. Professional interest groups. and at the annual conference and other activities. Our next fellow is Matthew Nagayo. Did I miss Desmond? I'm going to go with Matthew and then come back to Desmond. With Matthew Nagayo, Dr. Nagayo is an internationally acclaimed agricultural scientist, extension specialist, educator, and program leader specializing in vegetable crop systems, sustainable agricultural practices, plasticulture, and crop microclimate modification. He is credited with implementing numerous innovative research projects in crop production systems on a global basis, cooperative programs in the Americas, Africa, and Europe. Currently serves as national program leader at NEFA, and he has been an exceptionally active member in ASHS, assuming leadership roles in numerous groups, including as publications in horticultural technology editor for 12 plus years, and on the board of directors as the international vice president. Now I will backtrack, but it's not a backtrack. It's actually an extremely well-deserved honor. I've known Desmond for a long time, and this is, like all the others, very truly deserved. Dr. Desmond R. Lane. Desmond has been actively engaged in horticultural research, teaching, extension, and administration in positions at four land-grant universities. Quite an accomplishment. As a career pomologist, he has focused on addressing relevant issues in the commercial tree fruit industry through applied research and extension. He led Clemson's statewide extension horticultural team during 2006 to 2013. He has taught for two popular undergraduate courses at two universities. He's currently the head of the Department of Horticulture at Auburn University. He's won national awards for research and extension and has actively served ASHS since 1986. He is currently vice president of the ASHS Extension Division. And at one time when I first got to know Desmond, although Desmond is an academic brother coming from the same advisor, I first really interacted with him as Mr. Pawpaw when he was at Kentucky State University. So for those of you who don't know Pawpaw, Desmond was very critical in getting that issue off the ground.
Thank you. Desmond, thank you very much.
Our next fellow is Dr. Mark Van Eersel, University of Georgia. Mark is a professor in horticulture in the Department of Horticulture at the University of Georgia, specializing in plant physiology. His research achievements are reflected in a prolific publication record. Dr. Van Eersel combines his passion for plant science with a genuine desire to mentor students, having served as a major advisor to 24 graduate students. He has consistent and broad-reaching service to the ASHS has demonstrated his commitment to the mission of the society. Dr. Van Eersel has been recognized several times for his impactful research as well as his influence on students. And I can honestly say that I've never met anybody more passionate about the science of horticulture and the accuracy of the science of horticulture. And I have appreciated that keen accuracy in reviews from Dr. Van Eersel.